Hello and welcome to the Psychomedia Podcast. I'm Timothy Swan.
And I'm Ben Fell, and together we're going to be looking at the funny side of psychology.
This week, in our fifth episode, The Empire Strikes Back, or in reality, we're going to be looking at emotion, which is a subject close to my heart.
I thought we...
Come on!
Didn't we make the Empire Strikes Back joke in the second podcast as well?
I can't remember.
Maybe
I make
didn't.
So
Maybe
many that, Empire Strikes Back
jokes. It's a figment of my imagination.
Jokes. Well, trust
me. You can never have too many.
Next week's episode, I will be doing it entirely in the voice of Admiral Akbar. Apparently, I've been told off for doing creepy voices. That's right, I'm going straight into feedback.
Yeah, you have. Okay, well, yes, you have been told off for doing creepy voices. This is actually feedback from 2 weeks ago, but given as you're going to be doing the outro this week, I did feel the need to check, dear listeners,
it's
before
pertinent.
The podcast, that Tim wasn't going to do his dating chat line voice for his outro. It has in some cases caused, you know, severe psychological trauma, which has required medication.
Such a shame when my voice causes that, and an all too frequent occurrence. But fortunately, there have been people saying nice things about us or doing nice actions.
Hooray.
About us. So, for example, someone has what is called an RSS mix, where they mix together all the podcasts they like, and it's the Kingdom of Loathing podcast and the Hot Dog Network, which is like the spin-offs from that, Overthinking It, and Us, which makes them a supremely cool person because all of those other podcasts
wow.
are great.
Yeah. Go
and
you. You're
so,
an awesome person.
Yeah. Tell us who you are. I have no idea who you are, but our RSS
we can make,
feed
I mean, if you
can
like,
track
we can make
these
more,
sort of businesses.
If you like, we can make more references to like seal clubbers and turtle tamers, if that would please you.
Well, if anyone listens...
Tim, you probably don't get that because you never played Kingdom of Loathing.
Oh, no, I don't. I mean, Zach Johnson will be so ashamed of me. I listen to all his other stuff, like
That's
hours of him every week. And I do find that sometimes I do talk like him after I've had, you know, a dose of advice hot dog and video games hot dog. Anyway, so...
Oh, is that who it is? I was listening to that. That is the longest podcast I've ever listened to. I
wow.
didn't even... I got to the stage where I didn't realize that I was still listening to it. It just
yeah.
sort of faded into my
podcast that is longer than ours.
It was very good, though.
Oh, yeah, it's great fun. I wrote into them to ask how we should promote this podcast without being like, what did I say? Obnoxious. And they recommended like little micro business cards that if you ever meet anyone who you think might be interested, and only then give them a little thing with your URL on, because that's what they did when they were starting, like before Kingdom of Loathing. So that was helpful advice. Someone used the untrackable search engine DuckDuckGo to find us. Which either means that they didn't want to be like found looking for our podcast, or they just realized how much Google and Bing and Yahoo know about us, and how likely two of those companies are to sell that information to the Chinese government. And by sell, I mean give.
Hooray!
And we've got some amazing international listeners. I'm going to try and pronounce a name. I apologize if I get it wrong. Pavithra Muthalagan. Who is also known as The Silent Q on Twitter and Last.fm. And I would consider her the queen of our many Indian listeners, given that she is the only one of our Indian listeners who has spoken to us and she supported us from before the beginning. But yeah, she said, yeah. Psychomedia is pretty addictive. Just got done with number two. Highlights, the terrorist voice, the Inception study, and the Jennifer fight. Also, the whole of the tanning bit, XD, hashtag lol, hashtag episode two. Do you notice a pattern about those things, Ben?
Hashtag? I don't know.
They're all bits
What's
that
that?
I did. They're all bits
that
I did.
Is good. Well, she does know you from the Overthinking It podcast, and as we've already established, people who don't know me find it difficult to remember even my name. I consider myself the padding to your podcast.
Well, I'll come back to that. Kieran in Belfast said, one of my favourite things
sure
about
will.
At Tetrarch Angel's Psychomedia podcast is that they use Freud as a swear word, hashtag proper psychologists, which I approve of. The podcast Talking Questions clicked the like button on WordPress, and they have a podcast too. I haven't listened to it yet, but I promise you that I will. And also, I went round
to...
I went round to a friend's house the other day, and I'd recommended that he'd listen to the podcast. I went in to help him with some decorating, because they're having an extension so that they can fit in their children. And I went in, and his wife, who is also my friend, said, we've just been being entertained by you. I was like, oh, really? How? Because I just couldn't figure out how. He said, oh, we've been listening to your podcast. It's really good. It made us really laugh. And that made me really happy, because I wasn't expecting it. And it was really nice.
Lovely.
So finally, on the feedback element, I would like to apologise to all our listeners for leaving in the bit at the end where I say, and we're out, and then we're self-congratulatory about how well episode 4 has gone. Although we were happy with how well episode 4 went.
We were. I hope you were too.
It's a bit of poor editing on my behalf, and as I say, as soon as I can get a professional producer, I will. In the meantime, I really need to pay more attention when I'm editing. in case the, you know, all of the like libel and other offensive bits don't get cut out.
Yeah, all the just like racism and swearing and slagging people off that we do directly after the podcast. We want to keep that out.
We don't do racism. The rest of it is true.
Well, we don't do it. Some of us study it.
Yeah. Hey, Ben, let's go to the next section.
The next section. Oh, right. So, yes, Tim, what have you done this week?
What have I done this week? I went on the Overthinking It podcast, and since then I have felt completely on the West Coast time frame and feel tired all the time, which doesn't normally happen.
Thank you, Overthinking It, for ruining
my co-host. We talked about baseball, which I know a lot about now. And I'd just like to say that my favourite baseball team is the Thessalonian Princesses.
Where are they from?
They're from Greece. They are Greece's only baseball franchise.
That's amazing.
If you listen to the podcast, you'll find out more about them. What did you do, Ben? Did you watch a film?
I did watch a film, Tim.
Hooray!
That, however, is not the first thing I did. The first thing I did is I started my course this week, so I am now officially like a PGS? I'm a PG something. I'm parental guidance.
You're a PG tips.
Yes, which is like a probationary graduate student thing. Which is really awesome. I got shown around the department that I have been working in for the past 5 years, which was very useful.
Did they show you any of the secret doors? Did you go up to level F? No, level F scares me.
I've been to level E before, to be shown around all the old animal testing labs and like disused rat mazes and things. That was crazy.
Well, if you're ever going past the department, have a look up on top. And you'll see that there are some bits that are much newer than the rest of the building, which is like level F or level G. What are they doing up there?
Wow, that is kind of creepy.
It's now your job to find out.
That must be where the wizardry goes down, one would assume. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, so I started my course. I now have an office, which is scary.
Does it have your name on it?
But awesome. It doesn't have my name on it yet. It will do. It doesn't have anything yet. It has like 4 desks and 4 chairs. And I have worked out who two of my office mates are, but not who the other one is.
Do you not know them all?
Well, I've met 2 of them, because they're also like graduate fresher people. So that was really cool.
Okay, I just assumed that they would be like new from last year.
But no, not at all. Not at all.
That's not necessarily the case, is it?
So yeah, met loads of new graduate-y people. They all seem suitably mad and enthusiastic, which is what most freshers seem to be. But then I also like did what my clear role is in this podcast, which is padding between Tim's sections and talking about films. So yes, this week I saw.
Don't do yourself down.
No, I'll just let all our listeners do it for me. No, it's
okay. Okay, this week's competition. Whoever can send in the nicest but also true thing about Ben's contributions to the podcast.
I don't think it's necessary for it to be true.
We'll win. Bonus points if it concerns the film bit and not the psychology bit.
My self-esteem has plummeted, so I am terrified of being mauled by a bear. I saw Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which is a film I probably should have seen before, but this was the first time. It was awesome. Benicio del Toro was fat and wonderful, and Johnny Depp was bald and wonderful. And the only thing I have to say about it, other than that it's really good and you should watch it, is that for those of you who are not intending to become borderline catatonic drug users over the course of your lives, or who already, you know, those of you who haven't already become catatonic drug users over the course of your lives, this is probably the best way of experiencing almost everything about taking just ridiculous quantities of every known drug without actually having to take them. Watching the film does leave you feeling like a bad LSD trip has just happened. So that was fun. Also on the subject of films,
but in a good way.
Yeah, in a good way. Also on the subject of films, any of you who haven't...
Can I just jump in before you stop talking about Fear and Loathing?
You probably should.
It's great to watch as a double bill with Spider-Man.
Really?
Do a Tobey Maguire double bill.
Yeah, he was weird.
Because Tobey Maguire is the hitchhiker.
Yes.
Can't stop here. This is Bat Country.
The most distressing wig I have ever seen on any human being, ever.
Okay. This week, I tried to write for the BBC podcast Newsjack, which is something I do every week it's on. But as I sat down in my room with The Observer and The Guardian Online to try and write some jokes about the Conservative Party conference, I just read what George Osborne is going to do to labour law and workers' rights. And I practically threw up. I was so sickened by this thing I was reading that it just, I was overwhelmed with disgust, and I had to go and not do that for a while because it was making me too sick. Not sad, not angry, just like genuinely disgusted.
Disclaimer, other political parties are available.
I wish. It's not really true, is it? Anyway, this isn't a political podcast, and you know, we don't want to turn off listeners by, you know,
until we do the episode on politics.
Yeah, in which case, I'm going to have to learn the words to the red flag and the Soviet national anthem.
Does that mean that I have to like learn the Star Spangled Banner and or something in to balance it?
If you learn the Hendrix version, then yes.
Okay. I can
or make the Aguilera version.
How's that?
Yeah, pretty good.
I thought so.
I feel we're missing out doing a psychology podcast. Maybe we should do an imitating versions of national anthems podcast. But yeah.
Spin off.
Here's the belabored segue. I was disgusted. Disgust is an emotion. So we're going to talk about emotions.
Tim, I think we need to start introducing jingles because the number of belabored segues we have, we need a jingle.
What, like, so
belabored
I can just hit a buzzer?
Segue. Yeah.
Sorry, I talked over you. Do it again and I'll cut it and use it.
No, I won't. I won't.
What? I'll get the file somehow.
We'll do it later.
Okay. Just going to have a jingle recording session. Okay. So, emotion is actually one of the few areas in which I've done some actual genuine research. And by actual genuine research, I mean a horrifying thing that I regret to this day, which is not so dissimilar from most research, is it?
Yep, my master's thesis can attest to that.
Anyway, during our time at university, we had to do our own research project, but one of the other things we had to do was a collection of random practicals, some basic ones known as core practicals, which were quite straightforward and quite boring, and then a lucky dip of what was in general like collecting data for a grad student's cutting edge research called plot practicals.
You should probably say very badly collecting data for a grad student's supposedly cutting edge research.
What are you talking about? The one we did on Facebook was truly innovative. And we'll talk about it on another podcast just because I love the name of the researcher. one of the ones I did was on mood induction with Dr. Lau, who also supervised my project, who is a wonderful person who knows all sorts of things about anxiety, depression, and mood disorders, and is doing her bit to help them. But
big
turns
shout
out
to Jennifer Lau.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, definitely. Congratulations on your recent nuptials.
Hooray!
Isn't that lovely? But anyway, because this is, again, turning into academic gossip pod.
Another spin-off.
And by spin-off, we mean the founding principle of this podcast. in order to study depression, you can work with people with depression, but that can be sometimes difficult because if you suffer from a long-term mental health issue, which one in three of us do, and most of that one in three is anxiety and depression, you might not want people poking around and seeing how you react to things. You might want to, you know, focus on the more important things in your life and not be constantly reminded that you are, you know, especially depressed and whatever. So someone, and I don't quite remember who, came up with a way to induce a temporary state of depression in neurotypical, I'd say that instead of normal, participants. I don't actually know. I'll look it up. I'll put it in
this. It must be said before The Only Way Is Essex inflicted itself upon our screens. I feel if it had happened afterwards, then it would have been a much, much quicker process.
Yeah, what I would like to say about that is that at least it's not made in Chelsea. It would appear that it was invented by Martin in 1990. Yes.
Second names
and,
that sound like first.
Martin invented one type and Velton invented another. And then a guy called Westerman said, by our powers combined, that they
really?
Put the two together.
Not he doesn't have a first initial, does he, Mr. Westerman?
I'm afraid not. It's just in my thing that I've just looked up because I still have it on my computer, Westerman at L96. And, I might have a references at the end. Give me a sec. Westerman...
I knew a Westerman. A Westerman taught me connectionism for
a year. Oh, really? What was
Gert
the initial?
Westerman.
R. Westerman. And it's R. Westerman, K. Spies, G. Stahl. And Stahl is, I think, someone significant. And F. Hesse. Hess.
Fair enough.
I'm trying to find if there's any examples of the things we said. Just, sorry, this is a bit... I'm going into more detail than I was expecting to. But the point is, there is a way to accurately simulate depression in people who don't have depression, and that this works, that you can test it against people with actual depression and the effect is on their mood is the same. So this is a genuine way, and what you do is you play them some really sad music, which we used was Barber's Adagio for Strings, pretty depressing, slow to 50% speed to make it extra depressing, and then you have them read out some statements about themselves which are highly depressing. I'm afraid I don't have any examples in front of me, so I'm going to have to rely on my memory. The one I remember most is, sometimes I feel so guilty that I cannot sleep. And what you had were the people sitting there listening to the music, quite dirgy but very depressing, saying these things out loud. And all of the experimenters on one wall of the room, just like so tense and unhappy because they're doing this to their friends. They've brought in their friends for a mood induction study and they're making them feel actually depressed. Now, the people were laughing. They thought that they felt all right. But if you studied their mood, the statistics bore out that they were significantly depressed when the mood induction was done.
Yeah, this is the thing about it. Having I participated in this study, possibly for Tim.
No, it wasn't.
Or one of my other friends.
Maybe Mira?
Quite possibly. But and it is very strange because you do this and you read these statements out loud to yourself. And it's, the vast majority of people in that practical doing it were psychology students. So they were all immediately aware of what is going on. And it just gets ridiculous. You know, you're reading these ridiculously over-depressive sentences. It's like reading a passage of Marvin dialogue from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
There is no hope.
Yeah, and so it is funny. You find it funny, and you're doing it with your friends and giving each other sideways glances and giggling and desperately trying to keep a straight face. But somehow, when you take the ratings of mood and such before and after, it bears out. And even though people are consciously aware that people are trying to induce mood, it actually works, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. So that was pretty amazing. That's how we study it now. Since the 90s, we've had a way of inducing emotion. But the past, they had some other ways.
Yeah. So this is my first study of the week is hopefully going to provide something of a contrast to that. Because back in the olden days of psychology, before the scourge of ethics committees.
damn you, Milgram.
Damn you, Milgram. And yeah, all those guys. What was the name of the guy who did the Stanford prison experiment?
That's Philip Zimbardo.
Zimbardo, yeah. Guys like
Stan and Phil.
Stan and Phil. doing their wonder. So you've heard about all these like famously sadistic experiments where, you know, they ended up causing mass trauma to their participants. We may talk about them in detail at some point, but they have kind of, they've been done to death a little bit. The fact that what you don't hear is the fact that whilst these were the exceptional cases, quite a lot of the, in quotes, psychology that was being done at the time was, if not quite so sadistic, then certainly heading in that direction. So,
well, what they always say about Milgram is that at least he debriefed his participants, well, yeah, which is more than most people did.
Yeah. So the study that I've got here is called The Physiological Differences Between Fear and Anger in Humans. And it's worth noting that this is by a guy called Albert Axe, who sounds like a lumberjack superhero, which is wonderful. So more awesome experiment names. It was done in 1953. And so they were essentially confronted with the same problem that people who do mood induction are, which is how do you induce emotion experimentally? Because obviously it's very difficult to sort of hang around in public areas and wait until people start to express emotions and then pounce on them and give them questionnaires.
At least more than once.
Yeah. So
court orders than that.
And, you know, you do get tired after, you know, a long day's pouncing. Speaking as a social psychologist, pouncing is an integral part of any research. So they wanted to find out, because there are sort of quite well established physiological symptoms of certain emotions. You know, you hear about sort of physiological arousal, where you have like things like pupil dilation, heart rate, breathing rate, skin conductance, which is sort of an index of essentially how much you're sweating, I think, although it may be something slightly more detailed than that.
It's basically that.
Yeah. So they wanted to see if it was possible to differentiate between two, you know, strong negative emotions, anger and fear, based purely upon physiological symptoms. Now, Tim, you'll correct me if I get any of the psychology wrong on this, because you wrote about it in an essay. But
I'll try.
Basically, the way the experiment worked was they got a bunch of participants and they told them to lie on a bed for an hour and listen to some music, some nice music. And they were told that they were studying hypertension. And so all the participants were told that they were going to be lying on a bed for an hour and listening to music. What actually happened was, after they'd been lying there for 25 minutes, one of two emotion inductions happened. These were events designed to induce anger or fear. In the fear condition, the participants were connected up to a lot of recording equipment, you know, electrodes for their galvanic skin response, and there was a polygraph as well. So they had lots of wires and cables attached to them. And after 25 minutes, one of these cables attached to their little finger started to give them a series of small electric shocks.
Drink!
Which increased in their intensity. Yes, and those playing the drinking game, electrocution has been mentioned. So these shocks, they weren't painful, but they were increasing in intensity. So that, you know, might have made the participants a little bit sort of anxious, but not exactly fearful. Where the real fear came in was when they reported these shocks, and I quote, "The experimenter expressed surprise, checked the wiring, pressed a key which caused sparks to jump near the subject, then exclaimed with alarm that this was a dangerous high-voltage short circuit. The experimenter created an atmosphere of alarm and confusion." And this lasted for about 5 minutes, with people running around and, you know, telling the participant not to move or they might die. After 5 minutes, they removed the wire and the participant, presumably traumatized, went back to the music. So there are a few bits of a few in this study. There are quotes from the participants. One woman apparently kept pleading, "Please take the wires off. Oh, please help me." Another woman was praying to be spared during the fear episode. And a male subject said, "Well, everyone has to go sometime. I thought this might be my time." Now, okay, so that clearly demonstrates that the fear induction worked. However, it does also demonstrate a slightly different attitude of science participants towards the science that they were participating in. I'm pretty sure that even if they replicated it exactly, this study wouldn't work these days, because people would be like, "You're clearly not going to kill me. This is clearly like a joke."
Oh, really? You think that's what it would be? I would think that the fear condition would just lead to anger as well. Just be like, "I'll sue you! I'll sue you!"
Yeah, that's possible, I suppose. I mean, particularly the guy who was like, "Well, everyone has to go sometime." That's kind of a laissez-faire attitude to dying in the cause of science.
That's a sample from Pink Floyd's The Great Gig in the Sky.
So clearly the fear manipulation worked. So the anger manipulation was, if anything, I think even better. So the experimenters in the study, there was a science, like a guy in a white coat who was sort of applying the electrodes and in the room, and there was also a nurse, and then in a different room there was the guy operating the polygraph. And when the participants in the anger condition went into the study, they'd been told that the guy operating the polygraph was not the normal operator. He apparently was an ex-operator that had been fired for arrogance and incompetence and had been brought in at the last minute due to the illness of the regular operator.
They went all this trouble to make up the story.
It's amazing. And so again, after 25 minutes of lying on the bed listening to the music, this evil polygraph, this arrogant and incompetent polygraph operator comes in and says that he needs to check the wiring because there might be something wrong with the polygraph. Then the experimenter sort of expresses reluctance but eventually agrees and leaves the room to go and operate the polygraph. When, and I quote again, the operator shut off the music, criticized the nurse, and told the subject sarcastically that it would have helped if he'd been on time. He checked the electrodes, roughly adjusted the subject, and then criticized him for moving, non-cooperation, and other behavior. Given that the participant was just lying still on the bed, I don't know what that behavior would have been. I assume it would have devolved into just criticizing his, you know, dress and person and just generally.
To be fair, if in the 50s you went to an experiment as a man wearing a dress, then... You can't be surprised by a reaction that you might get.
So, yeah, anyway, once again, we have some quotes from participants on this. One female participant said, and this is wonderful and so very 1950s, she said, "Well, it's easy to see he is not an educated man," which is just beautiful. A male, sort of the other end of the spectrum, a male subject said, "Say, what goes on here? I was just about to punch that character on the nose."
Queensbury rules.
Queensbury rules. So what goes on here? I was just about to punch that character on the nose. That's, you know, inappropriate given that it's an experiment done in America in the 19th.
Yeah, we should really be doing our Mad Men voices, but I haven't had enough practice.
No, we'll pretend it was done in like 1920s England.
Yep.
This was this ridiculous mood induction. So just be glad if you ever participate in a psychology experiment that you weren't doing in the 1950s. And, you know, the slightly less humorous but nonetheless interesting results were that they found that there was actually a way of differentiating between anger and fear purely based on physiological symptoms. So for fear, people in the fear condition, they had increased skin conductance and greater respiration rate. And in the anger condition, there was increased blood pressure and muscle tension and a decrease in heart rate. So, you know, this is a sort of classic study, and the physiological and indeed the neurological symptoms of anger and fear have been greatly elaborated on since then. But it's the kind of the print that and the mood induction study both come from the same place in terms of the research question, but have just been approached in drastically different ways. And I have to say, the 1950 study does sound so much more fun.
Yeah, well, it's not exclusively the 50s that has the, what would you call it, monopoly on weird ways of inducing.
Well, no, you just have to look at the study from last week with the snake in the scanner. I mean...
Yeah, exactly. It's very similar, really.
That if they'd had scanners back then and ready access to corn snakes, I'm pretty sure that that would, you know... That would have been right up there, Ali.
Well, you know, this is like you were covered in sensors and whatever. You know, it's the closest thing you're going to get to a scan in that era.
Mm.
It's more than most people would ever kind of experience, I imagine.
But anyway, so those are two kind of introductory studies, or in the case of the mood induction, inductroduction-y studies to the idea of inducing emotion.
Yeah, well, so I'm going to talk about a study now that didn't so much try to induce emotion as try to make sure that it was being induced in a really specific way. from the very beginning of the study of emotion, that's going right back to before William James, the father of psychology, to Charles Darwin, about whom a lot is actually written in this literature. Darwin did reckon that emotion was proof of mankind coming from one single origin, because it was seemingly universal. And this was countering a lot of the ideas of the time. And of course, a lot of people used Darwin's ideas to suggest that there were differences between races and whatever in terms of their development, which perhaps shows that no matter what, you know, you background you come up with and science you come up with, there was someone trying to pervert it to say the thing they wanted to say.
Well, yeah, but I mean, that still happens to this day. I mean, you only have to look at books like The Bell Curve. I mean, that was, what, 10, 15 years ago? Which was this thing saying, at IQ differences between different races. Which is
without taking into account education, which is just like, if you can sink it in one sentence, that's usually a bad sign. But yeah, this is the thing. But Darwin, actually, like a lot of people at the time, said, well, Darwin's science is all very good, and we're glad that he's studying this, but I'm a real psychologist. He's just trying to prove his own theory to everyone. But since, people have tried to figure out whether, as Darwin suggested, and as James agreed, that smiling makes you happy, frowning makes you angry, that the facial positions that we uptake, or take up, or whichever way around you want those words to go, the whatever position your face goes in, that affects your emotion rather than the other way around. Because the natural thing to think is, I'm happy, so I smile. But Darwin reckoned that it could go the other way. And James reckoned that it probably did go the other way the whole time. Now, plenty of people have tried to prove facial feedback, and they haven't really gotten anywhere that can't also be explained by methodological problems. Because if you tell someone to smile, or even to move their lips, they're going to recognise the smile, unless they're an inhuman robot, in which case using them in emotion research is a bit pointless.
Also, I mean, it is difficult because, you know, it may well be that it's not kind of a physiological thing. It could just be the association you have between smiling and being happy means that if you smile, you kind of attribute the fact that you're smiling to the fact you are happy, and then you feel happy.
Oh, yeah, that is definitely a thing that I'm going to talk about later, because there's one theorist who says, I'm trying to prove that this is absolutely not the case, because that's a kind of cognitive way of looking at it. And some people think emotion and cognition are very separate, and some people think they're very similar. But anyway, you know, if you ask someone who doesn't recognize a smile as being happy, Mark, how you feel on the questionnaire, you can't. No, you can't write in like the death of all things of the cold end of stars. And incidentally, who brought John Hoam from Agalloch in here anyway? That's one for all our folk metal fans.
Niche joke.
You know, I tried to blag a promo copy of Emmanuel's new album this week by claiming we had a lot of post-rock and post-metal listeners. So if you are a post-rock or post-metal fan, do write in to prove me right so I can get a magical green CD with Emmanuel's new album before it comes out in about a month's time. Anyway, so the researchers doing this study, yeah, there's a study, Strap believes that a weaker version of what James and Darwin said, that if you have a face that accords with an emotional stimulus, then it will enhance an emotion. And if it doesn't match, then it will weaken the emotion. And this comes out of some also crazy emotional induction research by Pasqualari and Bull back in 1951. They used hypnosis to freeze their participants into certain postures that were emotional. So they had them like frozen, shaking their fist and frowning. And they wouldn't say, look angry. They'd say, okay, now lift your left arm. Now clench your fist. Now, you know, wrinkle your brow under hypnosis. And then they said to them, now feel happy. And the participants did one of either two things. Either they could not feel the emotion if they were in an angry position and you said feel happy, just like I can't feel happy, or they would break the position, which is quite hard in hypnosis to break a position that you've been put into. Obviously you have to be very suggestible. Now that is a complicated, confound filled experiment that you know you can't trust the results under hypnosis, and there's lots of, you know, experimenter effects and the rest of it, but there it has come on that there was some evidence for facial feedback, but no one had ever not proven it conclusively, but proven it beyond attack that it's like, well, they knew they were smiling, and they've tried to explain it. There's various different reasons. Is it because of social mimicry? If you smile, that's because you see someone else smiling, and so you know kind of from your motor system and your social system that that's because of happiness. Is it because we have these innate faces that a smile, which is found cross-culturally, like to the point of non-Western contacted cultures, or, well, obviously, for the first time they're contacted, they went to Papua New Guinea, which is like one of the few places where you can find such tribes, and showed them some pictures and said, you know, is this a smiling face?
That is worth pointing out. The in terms of sort of the cross-culturalness of facial expressions, the one which is just appears to be like completely pan-cultural is smiling. Once you get into more complex emotions, like, you know, disgust and surprise, there, whilst you may find evidence for them in other places, there is a lot more sort of contention as to exactly how cross-cultural they are.
It does depend on how much you believe that the guy who first did it really did it. But I think, you know, there's some people who say, yeah, there's six basic emotions that do work cross-culturally and anything more is more complicated. Certainly, I'd say happiness, anger, disgust work cross-culturally.
That's
a bit more dubious about sadness and surprise. But, you know, anyway, that's, you know, one of the reasons that people suggest. Or is it, you know, inferential that cognitively, though not kind of consciously, but cognitively, not emotionally, you go, smiling, oh, I must be happy, and then you feel happy because you know that you must be happy.
Yeah.
Or is like this a physiological mechanism that generates, you know, there's a stimulus, your body responds to it, and then your brain catches up. And this is a huge battle in emotional research, because there are two sides. One is held by Bob Zients, who I'm going to talk about one of his studies later. We talked about one of his studies last week. He is the living embodiment of science. And by living, I mean dead, because sadly he died a couple of years back. And Lazarus. And
who
Lazarus
presumably
and Zients,
isn't dead.
I think he's not. But Lazarus and Zients are basically the Buckley and Squire of this field in terms of the back and forth. But in fact, they're worse, because Buckley and Squire seem very reasonable if you compare them to Zients and Lazarus. Zients and Lazarus, they argue over which comes first, emotion or cognition. And if you look at the way Zients defines emotion and cognition, emotion comes first. And if you look at the way that Lazarus defines emotion and cognition, cognition comes first. And I have to say, I err slightly on the side of Zients, but in reality, they're arguing about nothing. And they've spent 30 years arguing about definitions, but refusing to agree on a definition when the good definitions probably lie somewhere between their definitions.
This is kind of a common trope in psychology, or indeed all science, I'm sure. The endless arguing over definitions. There's some studies that we might cover at some point about mental imagery.
Oh yeah, I'm thinking of that.
Which are fantastic, because the basic finding is that if you experience strong mental images, you believe that mental imagery exists, and when you do studies on it, you find that it exists. And if you don't have strong mental imagery, you don't believe that it exists, and when you look for it, you don't find it.
Yeah. Which is like a breathtaking look at science itself, which we'll have
it
to
is.
Do. But instead of breathtaking looks at science, breathtaking looks of Zients.
Zients.
Strath.
Oh, God.
Strath. Come on.
It has taken us a surprisingly long time to make that joke.
I mean, it was inevitable.
It was the freight train at the end of the tunnel coming towards us. But I'm glad that we have finally crashed headlong into it.
The only reason I call Zients the living, and by living I mean dead, embodiment of science, is because he's called Zients.
He is called Zients.
But Strack is like definitely in the Zients camp. But so many people on the Lazarus camp had gone, all your facial feedback, which would probably prove that Zients was sort of right. It's just like a cognitive assessment, because they know they're supposed to be smiling and they go, oh, I must be smiling, I better be happy.
I'm going on a Zients camp in a couple of months.
Yeah, you're leaving me.
I am. I might be able to do one from Australia.
I was going to sing the Bugle theme, but I imagine that's copyrighted.
I could go and find Tom.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, sorry.
I have to admit, I'm on Team Chris.
Well, yes, who isn't?
Anyway, yeah, Strack found an ingenious way to exclude any cognitive element of anyone figuring out that they were smiling. And basically, that means that he is a good liar. And actually, I think all good experimental psychologists are just good liars. A good deception in a study can lead to some beautiful, clean results. And I think Strack gets it. So they gave them three conditions, the participants. That's three conditions, because they claimed that they were testing how people who had suffered paraplegia would cope on certain tasks. And they said, this is a pilot study. We're going to test it on some real paraplegics, but we thought it's a bit harsh testing it on some real paraplegics before we know how easy or hard it is to do without your normal use of your hand. So they had them hold a pen either in their teeth, which makes it look like you're smiling and your muscles move so you're smiling, but you don't realise, lips, where it kind of makes you pout, basically, or in your offhand, which is a control. They did a whole ton of tasks, of which one out of like 30 was significant, as in important. I shouldn't use significant willy-nilly.
No, bad, Tim.
Word. Anyway, and they had them, the key task was rating the funniness of some cartoons. And they found that in the teeth condition, that's the smiling, secretly smiling condition, the cartoon was rated the funniest. And in the lips condition, it was rated the least funny. And if it was just the offhand, where obviously the face was free to move, it was in the middle. And this was a significant difference. So yeah, that seemed fine. But like most experimenters, they weren't fools. And they realized that asking how funny is the cartoon is actually asking two questions. It's asking how humorous is the cartoon and how amused are you by it? Actually, that last scale is known as the Queen Victoria scale. With zero being, I am not amused. That's literally what it says. Not the Queen Victoria scale.
Really?
But the bit about, I am not amused. And
good.
I was Strack
predicted that objective humour wouldn't be affected by the face condition.
Right.
But amusement would.
Subjective experience of it.
Now, it did find a statistically significant effect of the face condition with one proviso. And that statistical significance was one-tailed. Now, I'm going to explain that. I'm going to explain that by telling you my life slogan. My life slogan, which I have to thank Ben for pointing out, because I didn't think I realised it was my life slogan until he pointed it back out to me, is always aim for the ends of the bell curve, which means either be the very best or the very worst. Be average.
Just be extreme.
Be the top 2.5% or the bottom 2.5%. And Strax results, they don't fall in the top 2.5%. They fall in the top 5%. But for me, that's not good enough. Mostly because he's more optimistic than me. Walking, bottom 5%. Podcasting, I'm going to say top 2.5%. But that is a lie because it can be proven objectively. But no, you've got to aim. That's what you've got to do. Be brilliant or be terrible. And so I tried to look at the data to find out why he did a one-tailed test and why it wasn't quite significant. And it's so messy and rather ill-explained. But basically, it works if the smile is during actually seeing the cartoon rather than just rating them. That's like the closest I can get to explaining why it wasn't quite significant over the whole thing. There was a significant interaction effect there.
Right.
But then you have to explain it theoretically, and that was what he doesn't really do. The point is, the participants could not figure out the purpose of the study, and they couldn't, because so many times they're just like complying with what the experimenter wants. Can you remember that one, what that one is called? It's not social desirability, it's the other one.
Well, I thought it was essentially, you know, social desirability. You know, you want, you're in a social context where the appropriate response is compliance, so you comply and you want to do what the experiment wants you to do. But
yeah, but
that's,
it's like called like demand characteristics.
Oh yeah, like demand characteristics, yeah,
where you figure out what the experiment is, and because it's surprising that most people, I would think most people would be contrary, you figure out what the experiment is and you try and do it, which is a subset of social desirability, is where you want to look good in front of people.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. And so the results, even if they're a bit weak, they are genuinely because of the physical position. There was no way they could have figured out they were smiling, because it's so kind of absurd and unusual to have a pen in your teeth. I was about to do it with the pen I'm holding, but I don't really want to. And they reckon
it's kind of a way of interpreting the data, even though they didn't get a particularly strong result. The sort of absence of alternative explanations is one of the strengths of doing a deception study.
You know, that's what I say.
Mm.
They reckon it's this link between the motor program in our head, because we have all these motor programs for the basic actions that we do, like smiling or lifting our arm or whatever, and the emotional stimulus. And if you have like those two things, it's enough to trigger an emotion. Mm. So if you've got, there's something funny, my face is in the right position, you feel happy. And it later has been argued, which I'm not going to get into because it's quite boring, that there are so many ways to generate an emotion and you just need to reach a certain amount of them and it will set off.
So, in conclusion, stand-up comedians should force all their audience members to hold pens in their teeth when they're doing their gigs.
That is a good application. And by
everyone listening to the podcast, take a pen and place it in your mouth.
It's disgusting and metal.
So, Tim, tell me about the next study.
Yeah, we're going to mess with your heads because I'm going into another study that is me. Don't talk like that. I'm so sorry. But it's because it's Zience. Do you know what Zience's middle name is? His first name is Bob. His last name is Zience. His middle name is what I thought was Boleslaw. But apparently, if you do the proper Polish pronunciation, it's Bolsław. So he's Bob Bolsław Zience.
I prefer Boleslaw. It's the stage that they got to in culinary science just before they invented coleslaw. It's like it's got everything in it except the little carroty chunks.
That sounds so disgusting. But yeah, also kind of like Polish food. It's cabbage and mayonnaise. I don't know anything about Polish food.
No.
But I have heard that Eastern and Central European food is somewhat potato and cabbage dominated. But yeah, so we've already had people saying that smiling makes you happier, and people like Strack have tried to figure out why it's the case and prove that it is the case. Now, Zience falls on what is the kind of counterintuitive side of the debate, but it is the side that Darwin and James are on, and, you know, they were right about quite a lot of stuff.
Yes, William James, we may or may not have mentioned.
Yeah, we have.
Yes. The guy who sort of essentially came up with everything in modern psychology about 100 years before anyone else did.
He's the guy that everyone should associate with psychology instead of the F word.
Yeah, he really is.
One day.
Maybe that can be. Yeah, we'll try and mention William.
The mission
James
statement
as much
of this
possible.
Podcast.
Well, if we add it to the drinking game, then that'll probably help.
Yeah, we'll have to codify some proper rules. You know, I was watching Star Trek: The Original Motion Picture this week and The Wrath of Khan. Me and my brother were trying to find good drinking games. Not that we were going to actually drink, but it's fun to just be like, "Drink, hooray!" You kind of get the dopamine hit even if you don't drink, right? I think you do.
I think so.
Well, I tell you what, me and my friends tried to come up with a tea drinking game. It really just leads to burnt mouths.
Yeah.
Scalding mouths. Yeah,
that's not a good idea. You need something that you can at least technically drink in ridiculous quantities.
But, you know, Zience and Lazarus, they are kind of like Kirk and Khan. And I do imagine Zience is a kind of Kirk figure. He solves problems with his fists, with his lovin', and then with actual, like, compromise-based diplomacy.
But does that work, though? Because I think having yelling Lazarus doesn't kind of sound quite as good as Zience.
That may be true, but he, you know, if you watch that movie, and you should, because it's a great movie, you know, Khan does say Kirk quite a lot, just not as shouty, but he's just like, oh, Kirk.
They've got a lot in common, actually. James T. Kirk and Bob B. Zience. You know, they both have the standard English monosyllabic first name. The slightly peculiar and awesome surname by which they are known, and the interesting middle name.
Yeah, Boleslav. Well, if I ever get the chance to write in the Star Trek universe, I'll make a captain whose middle name is Boleslav.
Boleslaw, anyway. Tim.
Boleslaw. Oh, yeah, I'll mess up the pronunciation and just alienate all my Polish listeners. We do have
Polish listeners, Tim.
Oh, sorry. This is probably why it has all this trouble. I just see this as my own baby instead of our baby. Does that make me more like the mother then? Anyway, that's sexism or something. Zience thinks that smiles can precede happiness, and he says, I said, this is something I actually wrote in my essay, and I want to read it out because it's like the most pretentious thing I've ever written. And
really?
Egress. That's such a thing. Don't explain it. Do not explain it. It can be our thing.
I might.
I wrote, the major input to determining emotions would appear to be stimulus. There is some sort of consistent modulatory effect, which seems to act via cognitive inference or classical conditioning, that it is a cognitive process derived from past experience and present facial feedback, which is like so hedge-betty, it doesn't really say anything. But the point is that Emotional research is difficult. Defining emotions is really difficult, especially by the face. Because jealousy, pride, they're usually counted as emotions, but they are really hard to pick. And like, if you see a face, we've talked about this with the basic emotions, one that is clearly jealousy. Now, Zients goes through the literature and he looks at things up to about Strack, because it's about the next year, and says, there's about enough evidence to show that facial feedback exists, but no one really knows why. And was it the experimenters giving cues? Well, Strack's kind of excluded that. Is it people making the associations from these stereotypes? Because we kind of know that a smile symbolizes happiness, even if we don't always smile when we're happy. Is it classical conditioning? Because when you're happy, you smile, and so you associate the two together. Or is it self-appraisal? These are all very reasonable suggestions as to how this might work. But don't worry, Bob Zients is not interested in reasonable suggestions. He comes up with the most insane theory that I think I have ever heard, which has not led to someone being stripped of a doctorate. And that theory is called the vascular theory of emotional efference, or VTEE, or VTE. And that's actually relevant to what makes it work or not, as the case may be. Basically, for some reason, Zients came up with a scientist from the turn of the century who was completely forgotten. And this scientist found that facial expressions change blood flow in the face and then blood flow in the brain, and this affects the brain temperature, which affects the neurotransmitters, which affects emotions. And Zients believes this is the causal relationship in emotion.
So let's actually just briefly have that in layman's terms.
Okay, I've got it written down in layman's terms. We smile in order to cool down the brain, which makes us feel good.
That's amazing. It's wonderful. I am so glad that this theory exists. It sounds like something you would read in like Victorian case notes of some like dissection or something.
It's where it originated, but science couldn't leave it there. It's a zombie theory.
Stay there with phrenology and all the others.
Well, this is the thing. Now, science writes, if true, VTE organizes diverse findings such as biofeedback, placebo effects, unconscious preferences and aversions, the growth of preference with repeated exposure, empathy, and such actions as fingernail biting or scratching one's forehead. And what I have learned from that is that if true is a very significant phrase.
How does scratching your forehead even cool you or warm you up?
Well, apparently...
Or biting your fingernails?
Face temperature affects brain temperature. Now, the theory, and unlike some madcap theories, it gives a testable hypothesis that if facial expressions do change the temperature, which you can test, and this then affects emotion, which you can test, or if you change the temperature in another way, and this alters the emotions, then the theory can be supported. So this is a theory that is insane, it is mad, it is bonkers.
But it is testable.
And supported by the evidence.
Oh, God.
Let me give you some evidence. There's evidence that cooling the hypothalamus, which is the thermostat of the brain, amongst other things, has hedonic outcomes. I love the phrase hedonic outcomes. There is a multitude of sins that can be covered with hedonic outcomes. The areas that are linked to shivering are linked to emotional actions, which was found in snakes. They found that the bits of the brain that deal with shivering also deal with mating behavior.
Right.
Breathing definitely does cool the hypothalamus. Let me quote how they found this out. How recently did you eat, Ben?
About an hour ago.
Okay, I'm warning you, this is pretty disgusting.
Okay.
Using a reversible tracheal cannula...
That doesn't sound good.
Well, it's like a valve that you put straight into the trachea.
Oh, yes.
That you can open and close so the air will flow in and or out. They put that in a rabbit. They were able to observe rabbits that were either breathing normally, i.e. through the nose and mouth, or directly through the trachea, which bypasses the nose, the area where the air is cooled. And they measured the hypothalamic temperature that when you bypass the nose, the temperature of the hypothalamus goes up. When rabbits were breathing normally, the hypothalamic temperature was 0.3 degrees lower than the comparison temperature, the rectal temperature. Whereas
those poor rabbits.
Whereas when
that is a bad day for a rabbit.
Yeah, when the rabbits were greeted
like,
directly.
That rabbit is going to get home from work, I guess, and say to its rabbity wife, "You will not believe the day I had at the office."
Yeah, you thought workers were exploited. oh, have you seen the anonymous video? So in cool.
In David Cameron's new worker rules, workers will have thalamic tracheotomies and rectal thermometers as standard.
Yeah, and when the rabbits were breathing through the trachea, their brain temperature rose to the level of the rectal temperature. But don't worry, there have been some tests in humans to establish whether this is also the case. In the case of severe chronic nose bleeding, there is a procedure performed that consists of packing the nose with a gauze tampon. The pack is so tight that no ambient air reaches the nasal mucosa, and the patient feels essentially incapable of taking any air through the nose. The procedure results in a violent emotional reaction, quite often that of severe panic. When you remove the pack, the patient experiences excellent relief. Monkeys whose nasal airways were packed similarly developed severe distress symptoms. And to some rats, this procedure is fatal after only a few hours. And yet, there is no difference in the level of oxygen reaching the lungs because their mouth is fully able to breathe. But it's still pretty horrifying. If I shove my fingers up your nose, Ben, and I'm not going to do that, well, are you going to panic?
But, I mean, okay. I'm wondering just how much personal information to divulge here. As someone who has in the past experienced a great number of nosebleeds, it is true that one of the best ways of stopping them is just, like, blocking your nose. But, I mean, I, that doesn't seem to be particularly anxiety-inducing. It's just irritating. And B, like, if they're going to be doing that clinically in, like, strapping you to a bed and packing your nose with a tampon, then you think there may be some confounds in that.
Yeah. Zions is arguing that the only reason these people are feeling distress is because their brain temperature is increasing and not because there might be some sensors in the nose that say, "My nose is full of things. Save me from dying." Wow. I am nothing if not authentic and, you know, dogma 95 on this business. So what you might be desperately asking at this point is, what's the actual experiment? What did science do? Well, you will be surprised. Certain vowels make your face go a certain way. He uses the example of ooh, as in science is uber crazy. And they had some German speakers.
That rectal thermometer, oot. And anyway, that's
hello,
a Canadian rabbit.
Canadian
for you.
References. References? Listeners.
Is I think that why Canadians are so happy?
No, you is a bad one.
Oh, no. Is a bad is that why Canadians are so sad? Edit
but
that bit out.
But oh, I love the Canadian accent.
I love it too. I've met so many Canadians recently. It's wonderful.
Oh, great. Well, anyway, so he had these German speakers read stories that featured lots of yous or ooze, which is you umlaut, which I suppose I should have made more clear. And so, for example, there would be lines of Peter and Jürgen wished for Füchse und Hühner, which proves that Peter and Jürgen are idiots because those are foxes and hens, and who gets those as pets?
Incidentally, Tim, one of our friends, if she is listening to this podcast, will be in paroxysms of ecstasy right now.
I didn't do it deliberately. Often I do. Let's just say we have a friend who this study would mess the something up.
Mess the Freud up. And
oh,
never
yeah.
has that been more appropriate.
She is susceptible to German, even when it's from me, the world's least successfully seductive man.
And by susceptible, we mean susceptible.
I thought we said no creepy voices, Ben.
I said no creepy voices for you, Tim, and you just did German, which for
at least
one person is creepy.
Creepy voice Nazi now. I wish I could do an imitation of Seinfeld.
You were the one who were talking seductively in German.
Don't make me do that. I will dig up some of the stuff I've written in German. And no one wants that. And by no one, I mean one person really wants that. In so much trouble with her.
It's nice to know that I'm not the one in trouble this week.
Makes a change. Anyway, so they had them read the stories with you or you. And they measured the brain temperature and tested their levels of positive affect. Now, brings the temperature up because you kind of, it's not really a frown, but it closes the mouth a bit. It doesn't make you smile, certainly. Now, the affect ratings were significantly lower in this position, in the U one than the one. Now, it's worth noting at this point that they used forehead temperature, not actual brain temperature, because apparently properly measuring brain temperature involves sticking a thermometer directly into the ear until it touches the tympanic membrane. And the way you check that it's reached the tympanic membrane is you ask the patient, are you in agony? And Zients, perhaps rightly, thought that...
this might be a slight confound.
It would certainly cover up any of the happiness effects. So you've just got to take his word for it that forehead temperature is an accurate reflection of brain temperature. But, you know, he has cited some evidence. But Zients was no fool. And by no fool, I mean, within the logic of his madness, he knew what he was doing. He knew that this wasn't conclusive. What if the German words just led to this effect? You know, did the Germans just like some of the words that were in it? Because, you know, they were kind of pleasurable stories. You know, the ones with "ew" in were like about dogs and something else that is nice. You know, that was the comparison, that are nicer animals than foxes and hens. So they tested it with just reading the stories out to Americans and Germans, and they found that there was no real significant temperature change with when they were reading them audibly rather than having the person read them. But the Germans smiled at some of the stories because they understood them, and so there was some kind of confound. So they moved on to the perhaps more sensible of just having the participants repeat the phoneme over and over again, either I can't even do that because it's
I want to be like you,
and then
we're probably getting sued for copyright now, aren't we?
Which is the Canadian one. Germans and Canadians. And they had them rate the phonemes for how much they liked them, how pleasant they were, how familiar they were, and how difficult. Now the Germans found familiar but not difficult, but nevertheless found it less pleasant than O. And I'd like to break in here and say there may be a matter of phonoaesthetics here. You know, J.R.R. Tolkien, who was an academic as well as a writer, said that cellar door was the most beautiful sounding word in the English language, and that was because he was a serial killer.
However, I mean, it is interesting, isn't it? The idea of saying repeated syllables over and over again to make you feel happier. Maybe that's what Lady Gaga is so successful just for her name, but also from the opening to Poker Face,
well,
which is like mum, mum,
you
mum,
may
mum,
be
mum,
righter
mum.
Than you know, because R, which is symbolised by A-H, as in na, 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 but it's ma, sorry, I did a cover version where I changed the words, and the less said about that, the better.
Yes.
But anyway, quickly getting away from that. Zients wasn't happy with just negative affect. He wanted to do things that showed positive affect. And so they tested 7 phonemes, and the key ones were E or E, which makes you smile, or A, which is apparently makes you pleasantly surprised. So that's what Lady Gaga's song is about.
Pleasantly surprised that she can sing. Does that mean that fatigue makes you happy then?
Fatigue! Yeah, exactly. This is what I was trying to refer to, like a massive call ahead. Fatigue! But if you say fatigue, 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 you can feel yourself smiling. And E and R did lower the temperature, but not significantly. Or, as it's so commonly put, at marginal significance.
Maybe this is why squeeing happens.
It may well be. 0.06 and 0.07, which is close to significant, but not significant. Now, these were liked the best, and the correlation of liking and temperature change was significantly negative. The phonemes that made the temperature go up made you like them less, and the phonemes that made the temperature go down, you liked them more, and that was significant. So he's gotten away with it. He did get some significant results. But he thought, okay, maybe this phoneme stuff is weird. Maybe it is phonoaesthetics. Let's just go for the hardcore, straightforward, cooling down the brain. And so he decided to do an experiment that was ostensibly about smell. And he pumped into participants' noses either cool air, warm air, or room temperature air with the scent of oregano. Yep, okay.
That's oregano for our overseas listeners.
It might even have other names. I'm sure I heard that it had another name because it was on a quiz, but I can't remember what it was. Irrelevant. And they found that cool air and oregano were rated as more pleasant smells than warm air. People thought that they had a smell. And you can kind of think warm air does have a smell, doesn't it?
According to Dr. Doolittle, it does.
And temperature change did correlate negatively with the liking of the scent, but only in the warm air condition. Okay. Mm. So that was the experimental evidence. But science isn't finished. So there's another line of research that has a bearing on the link between brain temperature and emotion, and that can benefit from the concepts of fatigue. The metaphors hothead, boiling mad, hot under the collar, and cool as a cucumber are not altogether accidental.
And or, so it should be pointed out, the French version, cool comme une vache.
Cool like a cow?
Cool like a cow.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty sure that's accurate. Any French listeners, write in and tell me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure that cool comme une vache is
a thing. As cold as a cow spanner. Anyway, so, for example, he cites all of this famous stuff on anger and heat, and when it's hot, you get angry. For example, Reifman, Lyric, and Fine, from 1988, found that in Major League Baseball, the batter's likelihood of being hit by a pitched ball increases with the ambient temperature.
Well, there's the whole thing about riots increasing in seasons when temperature's greater.
Yeah. I mean, he does cite that as evidence for the fatigue. And, for example, he has a little footnote that says, the results we found about the effect of cooling the brain can be readily verified by the reader on the occasion of a mild headache. When such a headache arises, simply relax in a chair for a few seconds. Take 10 slow, deep breaths through the nose and exhale through the mouth. Relax for 2 minutes. Take 5 breaths through the nose, exhaling through the mouth. A noticeable relief will be felt. We have administered the procedure to 50 headache sufferers. Except for severe sinus and migraine cases, the procedure was effective in reducing the discomfort by a considerable degree, and it acted much faster than aspirin, virtually in an instant. For control purposes, the reader may try inhaling and exhaling through the mouth. One could speculate that the hedonic effects obtained here may be mediated or accompanied by an analgesia coming from the action of endorphins that might be released more readily in lower brain temperatures. I did actually try that yesterday, and you know what? Kind of worked. I was tired because I've been trying to read this massive article, and it did kind of work.
That's insane, but kind of awesome. I mean, that's the thing about this theory. Like, it seems, you know, at face value to be Freuding stupid, but there is some semblance of physiology and some semblance of science behind it, and quite a large semblance of science behind it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it kind of, once you start thinking about it, you suddenly find yourself drawing connections between other things, as we have aptly demonstrated by bringing up Lady Gaga and J.R.R. Tolkien.
Well, that's true.
I don't think there's many situations when those two pop up within several sentences of each other.
I'm sure I'll have to look up some stuff on YouTube to prove you wrong on that. I'm almost at the end of the things I've said, but he carries on equally mad and sane. Okay, so he accepts that key emotional researchers like Ledoux, who discovered the role of the amygdala in emotion, and we both know how much we like the amygdala, and also Edmund T. Rawls, who wrote a book called Emotion Explained, in which he explained all of emotion conclusively.
And ironically.
that he said that those two could be right as well, but the VTEE was complementary to them. I'm not sure The VTEE! For example, he quotes Darwin. He says it's interesting that Darwin implicated the respiratory and the vascular system in emotion. He said, in fact, that if the structure of our organs of respiration and circulation had differed in only a slight degree from the state in which they now exist, most of our expressions would have been wonderfully different. I wish I could talk like Paul Bettany. And then he says,
"That's my." I wish you were Paul Bettany.
Oh yeah, you could be Russell Crowe. Have you seen Russell Crowe as Kal-El? It's amazing. Denying that smiling is any different from sneezing or vomiting. Says. For example, piloerection, i.e. the hair standing up on end, and shivering serve both thermoregulation and emotional expression. He then points out that Lazarus is wrong, even though it's nothing to do with this article. He then says, the careless child withdraws a burned hand before experiencing the aversive hedonic state. A subtle pun, on the other hand, may not be appreciated nor reacted to with laughter until it has been extensively processed, like Bob Zients. And finally, the very final thing it says. Fourth, it is unlikely that emotional specificity is to be found at all levels of emotion analysis, the subjective, behavioural and physiological, given existing knowledge, close interrelations among these three aspects of emotional processes may be found only if distinctions among emotions do not go beyond hedonic polarities, which in English says, there's no point studying emotion any further because the VT only explains negative and positive, and so negative and positive are the only things that need explaining. And with that, we leave Bob Science safely behind.
Preferably behind a locked padded door. But I think possibly behind a locked padded door with access to a research division, because he does produce some interesting things. Were he alive?
Maybe he's still alive. Maybe he's producing something.
So thank you, Bob Science, for your contribution to science. It is wonderful. That was amazing. That's fantastic. I love those studies. And I'm now going to be breathing through my nose continuously and gripping pens in my teeth at all opportunities.
Who said psychology wasn't practical?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many possible practical implications of that study.
Yeah. Let's talk about a manly study, because the one thing I think I have over Ben in general in the manliness stakes is that I am somewhat more into sport than him. Only a bit, though, I guess.
Yeah, you certainly take more active interest in it.
I wish I could play sport, but that's only because I really can't. But I enjoy watching sport, obviously. I'm a big rugby fan. Indeed, every time I've tweeted a niche joke about my rugby team and the team they're playing, my team has won. The first week we played the Sharks, and I pointed out that Warriors are usually better than Sharks when the venue is land. And then we played the Saints, and I said that the Warriors are going to be echoing Nero and Diocletian by persecuting the Saints, and we won. But I forgot to mention how good Warriors were against Harlequins, so they beat us. Anyway.
Is everyone, are the members of the teams who you've been playing followers of your Twitter feed? Because that might explain their lower performance.
I would like to think that none of them have got their smartphones out on Twitter, because I'm using my smartphone in the stand after kickoff. Or immediately before kickoff. They go back to the dressing room and they've just got my tweets on a big screen. That'd be amazing. I'll work on that. Might take some hacking. So I've got a study here that is about sport. Because, you know, the question I would like to ask is, what possible reason could you have for studying football players in psychology? And I've thought of quite a good one is the impact of being valued on £47 million making you a whiny child. That's right, Man City fans, or one of you, and that's also two Tevez jokes in two podcasts of different sorts, but sequentially, that makes me the king of sports jokes. Anyway.
You're definitely the Andy Zaltzman to my John Oliver right now.
Hooray! We all know that Andy is the
funnier one.
Because I have
Freud all idea what you're talking about.
And you're not Jewish, you just like the look. That's what John Oliver says. Anyway, so Stemmler, who is German, and Germans do love their football, he made some footballers imagine some things that might happen during a game of football and measure how that affected their bodily responses. It might have measured how that affected their affect. Because one of the things that I haven't mentioned is that, yeah, in research, emotion is often called affect because that's a slightly simpler concept than emotion. But it's quite annoying because you have all these studies where they're affecting the affect. It's a good thing they're footballers, otherwise they might be people with affectations. Mm-hmm. But people link anger and fear because despite what Axe looked at, most people have struggled to find a good, clear physiological difference because the fight or flight system is the thing that gets active in both anger and fear. Some people think they are two sides of the same coin. For example, Lazarus. Some people don't believe in emotion. Surprising but true, they believe in action readiness. What we would refer to as fear is analysing a threat and preparing to flee. And that's all it is. That the subjective element is just kind of a weird, well, they would call it an epiphenomenon, but that's a philosophy term. It's pointless and irrelevant. That it just happens to be there and it's a coincidence.
Labeling
and doesn't mean
that applies post hoc.
Yeah. And Stemmler does not believe this. He's seen that you can tell the difference between positive and negative by looking at the autonomic stuff like heart rate and sweating and muscle tension, but the six basic emotions that are commonly referred to, anger, fear, surprise, happiness, sadness, and disgust, are really hard to tease apart by body stuff. but he believes it's because we aren't looking at the subtle differences between what he describes as the SAM system and the PAC system, or in my consideration, Serious Sam versus Pac-Man. Sympathetic adrenomedullary versus pituitary adrenocortical. And
those old characters.
More simply, effort and threat. And so Stemmler and the team believe that three things determine our body's state. The ongoing regulation, because, you know, we do have to keep our bodies working, but then emotion, and then after that, action readiness. That the two are separate, they're not just one and the same. And so they wrote up some imaginary scenes that feature a mix of anger and fear and withdrawal and approach. Most of the time you associate fear and withdrawal and anger and approach, and some people would say that's all it is. But they wanted to see if you could tell the difference. And so they put, you know, this scenarios into these footballers' heads. In the anger condition, they were told by the coach that they weren't playing in the most important match of the season, and they'd either get in his face and protest or storm out of the changing room. So you've got the anger approach, anger withdrawal. Fear condition was that they'd been playing badly and this is their final chance. Just as they were doing a good run, a tough defender tries to tackle hard. They can either sidestep and keep dribbling forward or turn and pass back. And to make sure they had some good comparisons, they first had some neutral scenes. One, just you are jogging for about 4 minutes. And one, it's winter. You're at a bus stop. Some children go past. You wave to them, which is all like emotionally neutral. Although I think waving at children shouldn't be emotionally neutral. It, you know, you should be jolly at least.
At the very least.
Yeah. And so, but they got the baseline readings from that. Fair enough. So they then questioned their emotional responses and their what would you do in this situation, and how well did you imagine the situation, and measured their bodily ones. They then did a statistical technique known as the Ronnie Ankover, which is analysis. Yeah, I think I finally topped hippocampus, except that no one knows what Ankover is. It's a measure of covariation, i.e. the extent to which two things are powered by the same... I don't want to say thing again. That
for stats nerds out there, Ankover is the bastard love child of Anover and regression.
Clean podcast, Ben. Well done. I think we're allowed one. I mean, if X-Men First Class is allowed one...
That's not a swear word. That's
you're
a technical
using it
term.
Scientifically. Good. Fine. No problem.
You can beep it if you like.
I really don't want to.
Well, I want you to.
Oh, not again. What's the...
Beep it.
About
beep
32.
It.
Bleep. See, I've written it down. Are you happy now? Are you happy?
Yes.
Just say
yes.
Your tea a few
my
times.
My face is extremely open.
So, yeah, they measured the covariation, i.e. the extent to which anger and approach are the same statistically. And they found that emotion and action were independently affecting the bodily responses. And they did this orthogonally. So withdrawal approach shows a shift in patterns, and anger fear shows a shift in patterns, but they're independent. Withdrawal generates the same patterns whether it is in fear or anger, and anger generates the same patterns whether it's in withdrawal or approach. And you could tell just by looking at the autonomic patterns which of these quadrants the person was in, which is an amazing breakthrough in emotional physiology, proving the bodily effect of emotion.
And they didn't have to electrocute or traumatise anybody.
No, they just measured some things. Although they did have some problems. They said, due to a software problem, four of the variables could not be analysed, which is an interesting thing. And I wonder what peer reviewing is like, because it's obviously not something I'm ever going to get the chance to do. But it's just like, you lost some data. How did you manage that? How did you lose some data and not all the data?
Yeah.
Maybe you have more experience with this than me, but
yeah, let's not get into it. It's the boring and depressing side of doing psychology.
Yeah, well, anyway.
i.e. the data.
In terms of the subjective response, they did feel the emotions that were fitting to the situation, but not always the actions described. So there may be a confound, but they got a good effect, so it doesn't seem to be a problem. The person certainly imagined the withdrawal, even if they thought, oh, I wouldn't withdraw. And that might be more personality-based if you're a more approachy kind of person. I think that's fair. So the results were small, but they were significant, which is more than you can say for some things that we've discussed today. And they pointed out that footballers are too fit to show big physiological effects purely by imagining things, which is always weak. It works and it's significant, but it's small. I guess the effect size is probably small. But they conclude that emotions are real they can't just be broken down into positive and negative, or they can't just be said to be action readiness. Even when they're imagined, they show unique biological patterns. And this is the point I want to make. I believe in emotions. They may be complicated and confusing, and I'm certainly not someone who always understands them, but I believe in them.
Well, that is nothing if not a good point to end this podcast on. As someone who didn't study emotions, I have been thoroughly convinced of their existence. I will now spend the rest of my day going for tea at everyone I meet and forcing pens into
until the podcast is released, because then you can do that to approximately 60 people across the world and they'll understand.
Feedback for this week: I would like to hear of situations where you have cooled the front of your face in order to make yourself feel happy.
I would like to hear nice things about Ben.
I'd like to hear nice things about Ben too.
So that his face will make E and R sounds.
Yes, if that can include sending cute pictures of animals. That works too. I think that's a good conclusion. We have decided that emotion probably does exist, despite how awesome science is.
Yep, I agree.
So as always, feedback to psychomediapodcast@gmail.com. Or
at Tetrarchangel on Twitter. Hey, we're getting into a pattern here.
We got it right this week.
Rhythmic.
Next week, the podcast topic will be...
I want to do Ramachandran.
Okay.
That was my suggestion next week. For our listeners, because he is an Indian American.
Okay, well, in
that
case...
And also, he's so awesome that no matter where you come from in the world, you will love Ramachandran.
In that case, I will have to borrow... What's his book called?
Oh, I can't remember. Does your girlfriend have it?
She does, and I will borrow it from her and try and read some of it before next week's podcast, because once again, Ramachandran is a Tim thing. But from what I've heard of him, he is extra awesome. And if he is Indian, then next week will be our...
I really hope he is. I don't want to embarrass myself.
Well, yeah, maybe. We won't go into it in too much detail now in case we're horribly wrong.
All right. Bye for now.
Bye for now. For tea!
My name is Timothy Swan, and I'm an emotional researcher-holic. I love shoving pens in people's mouths, changing the airflow to their noses, getting them to imagine scenarios while covered in sensors, pretending to electrocute them, reading them passages from various heretical texts, which we may have excluded today, but we, you know, do it. We're heretics to the core. And the first step is admitting that I have a problem. In fact, that's cognitive primacy. Oh, damn it, I was sober for such a short amount of time. And if anyone feels angry at my portrayal of addiction, just ask yourself, is your face angry? Are you perceiving your own emotion? Just say for tea, you'll feel a lot better. I am clearly going to remain an addict for the rest of my life. Vati!